I think the last time we chatted, it was on the occasion of the vampire Lestat.
Right.
That was a couple of years ago. And obviously, you've been very busy, I understand, in reading the voluminous publicity material that cut off repair, that you have even moved back to your old hometown.
That's right.
Tell me about that move.
New Orleans is just one of the most beautiful cities in the world, as far as I'm concerned. It's great to be back there.
Better than San Francisco?
Oh, yeah. For me, it is. I mean, San Francisco's beautiful, but it's a cold kind of geometric beauty. And it's also physically cold. I was cold for 28 years. And so now I'm warm again. I mean, I would give anything for those summer nights, going out on the front porch of the house at 10 o'clock in the evening in the summer and being able to sit there in the warmth and, you know, feel the breeze off the river. It's just priceless. I mean, I really crave that. But it's
you won't
really
be saying that in August.
Well, I did. I was there in August. I loved it. But you have to realize all that section of the South is so over-air-conditioned that you could catch pneumonia indoors in the South in the summer. Everybody has air conditioning. We have it. We have powerful air conditioning. So we have the beauty of an antebellum house cooled down to about 68 degrees inside, and the wonderful porches outside for sitting and feeling the river breeze and the humidity in the air and listening to the cicadas sing in the oaks and all the things I love.
But your husband, Stan, was teaching creative writing in California.
He's taken an indefinite leave. In fact, he may retire. He's been teaching for about 23 years. So he may be ready to leave teaching. He was the chairman of the creative writing department there for 8 years, San Francisco State University. And he's really, I think, ready for something different. He's been painting since we got to New Orleans. He has an art studio in this house, and he's done several large canvases already.
Oh.
So it's very good for all of us.
Why isn't he illustrating your books?
Well, I don't think Stan's an illustrator. He's doing his own thing, as he always has. You know, I included his poetry in The Queen of the Damned, but it wasn't poetry he wrote for my book. It was material that I went and found in his books and in his unpublished manuscripts, and I was amazed to discover that there was a relationship between his imagery and the ideas I was working with in the book. But it wasn't something he created for that purpose.
Well, I know, of course, you have this long affection for New Orleans, but somehow I have associated you with San Francisco for so long, I never thought you'd be leaving.
I was cold for 28 years. It was time to leave. New Orleans is my home. I have to live there in the shadow of those churches where I went to Mass and near the cemeteries where my family are buried. And maybe it's not that way with everybody, but with me it is. The writer in me needs to go back. You know that the poem of Yeats, I must go back to the place where all ladders start, in the foul rag and bone shop of the heart?
Mm.
That's it.
Mm. Well, Vance Bergelet lives down there now. Teaches, I think, at Louisiana State. And, of course, Walker Percy lives outside of town.
Yes, I hear a great deal about the great Mr. Percy, and I'm honored to be living so close to him.
I'm sure he'll buy you a drink. Give him a ring.
I'll have to stop.
I called him once and I said, I'd like very much to talk to you. And he said, well, I don't do interviews, although he did do one with New York Times, I discovered. But he said, I don't do interviews, but look, you're down here in New Orleans, stop over, I'll buy you a drink.
Nice.
It's the next best thing.
Nice. A very Southern approach, I would say.
Well, a lot of well-known writers started in New Orleans. Robert Stone won the National Book Award for Flag for Sunrise, and of course Tennessee Williams and Truman Capote.
And Sherwood Anderson was down there for a while, and William Faulkner. And Hemingway really loved New Orleans too, I think.
Elmore Leonard?
Yes, yes. It's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful city. I think San Francisco, Boston, and New Orleans are the three really different looking and feeling cities in the country.
Why do you have this obsession with vampires?
Actually, I don't think of it as an obsession with vampires. I think of it as an obsession with good and evil and immortality. And vampires have proved to be the perfect protagonist for the kind of books I want to write. I happened on them by accident, really. You know, sitting at the typewriter as an unpublished writer, plugging away every night on different short stories and different pieces of novels. And one night, just by accident, I decided, why not see what it would be like to interview a vampire? And when I stepped into that vampire's body, so to speak, started looking through his eyes, everything came to life vividly that I've been trying to see and do.
Well, as a younger person, before you started writing, did you have some idea about what a vampire was?
No. As a matter of fact, when I started writing Interview with a Vampire, my whole notion of vampires came from a black and white film I'd seen called Dracula's Daughter. It was a very atmospheric film made in the 1940s, a sequel to the original Dracula. And it portrayed vampires as doomed, tragic figures. And I loved it. And Most of what I put into the book sort of spun out from that. It was as if I was writing the backstory for that, you know, interviewing those characters and going into their romantic milieu and finding out what they were really about. It was an instinctive, kind of spontaneous thing. And then as I began to, you know, evolve a sort of mythology of my own, I began to keep some aspects from the movies and throw out some others, and keep some things from tradition and throw out some of the others. I made my own myth, really, just the way Bram Stoker did when he wrote Dracula, and the way every vampire writer, every novelist who's ever dealt with the theme has more or less made up his or her own mythology. And that's what I did. But really, it's the larger exploration of that figure as an outsider, as an outcast, as a sort of dark god, a kind of echo from mythology. It's that larger exploration that has always fueled me as a writer. And I think that's what gives the books the particular quality. If people respond, they're responding to that. You know, it's not just vampires. I mean, vampires themselves are comic book material. You know, I mean, that's what I would have advised anybody in 1976 who'd come to me and said, what about a book in which all the main characters are vampires? I would say, you must be kidding. But that's just what I did, because it worked. It was the perfect way to talk about those larger themes.
But there's a historical precedent for vampires, isn't there?
In fiction? Oh, definitely.
In real life?
No, well, I don't think so. I mean, not anything that I think we need worry about on a night-to-night basis.
Wasn't there a Hungarian baron or prince or something who was alleged to have been a vampire?
Not at all. What there was this character, Vlad Tepes, or Dracul, or Vlad the Impaler, this Transylvanian monster that apparently defended the borders of his country in ancient times. And Bram Stoker, when he was writing Dracula, he based Dracula on that figure. But nobody in Vlad Tepes' time thought he was a vampire, least of all Vlad the Impaler. I mean, he was just a tyrant and a sort of a military genius at times. Of sorts. And now scholars have gone back and they have dug up all these facts about that man, and his castle is now Dracula's castle on the tourist maps. But no one ever thought he was a vampire. No one to this day in Transylvania ever thought of him as a vampire. That was entirely a literary idea of Bram Stoker's, to create this wonderful Prince of Darkness and base him on this historical figure. It would be, you know, like me going back and saying Napoleon had been a vampire and was now my main character.
What is a vampire to Anne Rice?
Well, a vampire, in all books and movies, is basically a blood-sucking revenant, somebody that was once alive and is now technically dead, but has an existence in sort of the twilight zone between life and death, and it must drink blood to sustain that existence. And generally, in fiction, the vampire is a rather charming, compelling figure. I mean, before Bram Stoker's Dracula, there was Sheridan Le Fanu's Carmilla, and before that, there was Dr. Polidori's Lord Ruthven, the first vampire ever in English fiction. And there was even a Penny Dreadful best-selling vampire called Varney the Vampire in the 1850s, who just swept Europe. Everyone was buying these bestsellers about Varney the Vampire. But they're always sort of elegantly dressed, charming, doomed creatures who need to drink your blood. Now, Dracula is purely evil. My vampires tend to keep their human conscience. They're a little too smart to be purely evil. They know that they're doing wrong, and they're tormented by it. And they have a keen appreciation of human life. But the basic myth is that it is this damned soul trapped in an immortal body that must sustain itself through drinking the blood of the living.
Well, in addition to the human qualities, how do Anne Rice's vampires differ from the traditional fictionalized vampires?
Well, my vampires can see themselves in mirrors. They are not frightened of garlic or crucifixes or anything of that sort. And they basically have slightly different rules about what can destroy them. Nothing magical can destroy them. They aren't destroyed by stakes through the heart or anything of that kind. They have to be physically demolished, as by fire, or the sun. The sun can kill them. They cannot roam around in the day. And I found out, interestingly enough, after I had written two of these books, that the idea of the sun destroying a vampire is actually a Hollywood idea. It was Hollywood writers that put that in the movies. It's not something that comes from the vampire legends of Eastern Europe or ancient times or anything of that sort. But I think it's a beautiful idea, and I'm glad I included it, because I think the idea that you give up the light of the sun and the warmth of the sun as the price of immortality is quite a lovely thing to work with in a book.
Well, there's been somewhat of an evolution in your books. The Interview with the Vampire is, in many respects, kind of a traditional vampire story. We move on to the vampire Lestat, who becomes a rock star. And now we have The Queen of the Damned. Tell me how these books are related and how they differ.
Well, Interview with the Vampire begins with one person, Louis, telling his story of how he was inducted into vampirism and what happened to him and how he discovered all his different characteristics as a vampire. And Louis goes on a quest to find out what the history of the vampires is, but he isn't able to discover it. The history is sort of lost in obscurity. The vampire Lestat, really, is devoted to Louis's mentor, Lestat, a much more energetic and mischievous and, in general, outgoing creature than Louis. And the vampire Lestat writes his sequel when he discovers the book Interview with the Vampire. He decides that he wants to tell, you know, Louis has published this book and told the tragic story of what happened to him, and so Lestat wants to give his side of it. And he does reveal in the process the history of the vampires, which he always knew and could never reveal to Louis. And then The Queen of the Damned is really the sequel to The Vampire Lestat. It kind of finishes the story of Lestat coming out in the 20th century as a rock star and revealing that history not only to Louis but to all the vampires and stirring up a sort of war in heaven or hell, depending on your perspective, you know, with all the immortals.
And, of course, you introduce a lot of new characters in Queen of the Damned, but I have a feeling this is not going to be the last.
No, it won't be. I'll do another one called The Body Thief, which is an adventure of Lestat's. I mean, these characters really have me hooked. I mean, they travel with me everywhere I go, and I think of them as real people. And I'm delighted when I get calls from readers or letters from readers asking very specific questions about them as if they were real. You know, it just thrills me. So I know there'll be a fourth book, maybe a fifth. I don't know about that.
You certainly have made blood-sucking very sexual.
Well, that's a theme, really, that I inherited from my literary influences. Bram Stoker made it fairly erotic, and so did Sheridan Le Fanu, and so did everybody. You know, I think that's inherent in the image, that the vampire is a human supernatural monster. You know, he's not Godzilla. He's not the mummy. You know, he's really somebody with who needs warmth and love, and he's really going after life itself in the blood. And it's intimate. So, I mean, I didn't bring that to it. I kind of inherited that and amplified that.
How do you reconcile your interests with vampires, with the Catholicism of your youth?
I don't reconcile anything with the Catholicism of my youth. That's not possible. I try to transcend the Catholicism of my youth.
Yeah, it would be tough because I would assume that a concept of vampires, no matter how fictional, is something that would not be consistent with Catholicism.
No, not at all. No, but I mean, I'm not a Catholic in any real sense. I mean, what the Church gave me was often what a European background gives someone. You know, it gave me a great, wonderful experience with Latin, with hymns, with ceremony, with all of those different things, and a sense of history too. A sense, the history of the Church itself was the history of Western civilization to some extent. But I am not in any way a believing Catholic, and there's no attempt to recognize this. As a matter of fact, all these books could be interpreted in a way as the story of someone who has lost that faith and is questing, you know, looking for answers. These creatures find themselves in a world where they don't have any proof of the existence of heaven or hell, and they have to grapple with their guilt and grapple with the fact that they don't know where they're going and they're afraid to die. It's a story of all of us, I guess.
Of course, you're well known for your vampire novels, but it should be noted that you write under a couple of pseudonyms, and some of the books are supposed to be extremely erotic in nature. How did you fall into that genre?
Well, I have two pseudonyms, and one, A.N. Roquelaure, is one of those pseudonyms, and under that pseudonym, the books are pure erotica. That's exactly what they are. They're pornography. And they were written to be that and nothing else.
Is erotica the same as pornography?
As far as I'm concerned, it is. I don't see any point in making any distinction. I think these books are, I think, rather elegant, and they're well written. But they're designed to cause sexual arousal or pleasure, and they are pornographic. That's the whole point. I wrote the pornography I could never find in stores. All I could find was coarse garbage written by hacks, and so I decided to write what I consider to be a really fine piece of pornography. And that's what those three books are. They're sort of in a fairy tale setting, and they aren't gruesome, though they do have dominance and submission and this type of thing. And apparently they're very much enjoyed by both men and women. I get quite a wonderful response from both men and women. They transcend gender. They're not sexist pornography.
That's interesting. Is there a difference between women and men's pornography in general?
Well, I don't think we have very much women's pornography, so it's hard
to
say.
Well, we have yours.
We do now, and I would say that there is not a whole lot of difference, except perhaps that most pornography written for men pretty much has women in a submissive position. In my pornography, it can be either way. It can be all different combinations. And I really think that masochistic fantasies, for example, are something that men and women share. They both enjoy them. There's a lot that we share. I'm more interested in what we share and what transcends gender than I am in what makes us distinctly different. I've always been interested, really, in the transcendent, you know, view of everything. In the vampire books, gender doesn't really matter. And men fall in love with men, and women fall in love with women, and women fall in love with men, and men with women. I mean, one of my theories is once you're outside of life like that and you're looking at all of it is going to be beautiful to you. And you're going to see the important aspects of any one individual. And maybe gender just isn't one of those important aspects.
Weren't you taking a risk in shocking your family, your relatives, and even the readers of your vampire books?
I don't think I'm taking any risk in shocking my readers. I think that they love to be shocked, and they've enjoyed it. And I've never gotten any negative feedback on the erotica from my readers. Now, when it comes to my family, yes, I used the pseudonym for a long time to protect my family because I knew there would be people who would be embarrassed and even hurt by somebody writing with the kind of abandon with which I write about sexuality. And that was, but now that, I mean, I have told them now. I mean,
you came out of the closet.
Sure. I mean, I was proud of the books, and I didn't want the pseudonym to be construed as some kind of question of shame or embarrassment. So I've always been very frank telling people that I wrote them. When it started to appear in print that I was the author, then I warned my family. And I simply said, please don't read the books. They'll make you unhappy.
They read them anyway.
I don't know. I don't think so. They don't talk too much about them.
Last time we chatted, you said you had a listed telephone number and people all over the country called you.
That's true, I do, but I may have to change that soon. The calls are getting a little too heavy, and I'm not able to work as much as I'd like to work.
Why don't you get an 800 number?
An 800 number, I don't know.
Connected to, you probably have an answering machine, don't you?
No, I don't. I am the machine. You're looking at it. I answer the phone. But again, I may have to change this soon. It's been wonderful, though. I have gotten calls from all over the country and all over the world. The last couple of years, I've gotten a few calls from Nova Scotia and Australia and England and Germany. And the people are usually wonderful. They don't talk for more than a few minutes, and they just talk about their response to the books. And they generally say very nice things.
Well, do they ask you specific questions?
No, they generally call to say how strongly they identified with the characters. That's almost always what they say. How much they identified with them, how much they appreciate the style, and when is the next book. Sometimes they'll ask about the movie. When is the movie going to be made? And I tell them that there's a movie in the works and we have high hopes and so forth and so on. They don't generally get into anything too specific. You know, sometimes, occasionally.
Chevy Chase is not going to play the vampire Lestat, is he?
Wouldn't that be a kick? No, I hope Rutger Hauer. Rutger Hauer, actor that I deeply admire. I hope he'll play the vampire Lestat.
Yeah, he was in that sensational science fiction movie.
Blade Runner. He was wonderful. He was the head replicant. Yeah.
Yeah, and also I think it was Nighthawks.
Lady Hawk, yeah. He was terrific in Lady Hawk.
No, Nighthawks.
Oh, was there a movie called Nighthawks, too?
Wasn't it the one with Sylvester Stallone?
Oh, I haven't seen that.
That took and Hauer, I believe, played an international terrorist.
Oh, I have heard of that. Yes, I have to catch up with that one. I've seen everything but that one. Yeah. And maybe one other thing he did.
Yeah, they hijacked the Roosevelt Island tram, or Hauer hijacks the Roosevelt Island tram. So
I have something to look forward to because I haven't seen that.
Yeah, well, go to your neighborhood video store and pick it up. Well, I think the last time we chatted, you said you were using a computer called an Apricot.
Oh, I switched. I'm using a compact portable. It's really wonderful. Very, very fast. Fastest keyboard I've ever had. And I've always been a fast typist because I'm hearing all these words in my head, like spoken language, you know, and it's moving very fast. And my fingers move just about as fast as my brain, so the computer's perfect.
Well, the Apricot was a pit anyway. The pit. It's English, you know, you couldn't get parts or anything.
It was bad. It was bad.
Well, I could have told you that. Well, as always, it's a pleasure talking to you and reading your books, and you really have developed into a cult figure, and especially so when you have beautiful young guides to take you around. I can see that you haven't made, because many of my authors just struggle to get up here by themselves. They hit the subway and everybody ignores them. So now we have a celebrity vampirist, our own Queen of the Damned. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks very much for having me here.